Hello and welcome to the Classic Car Weekly podcast. My name is Chris and this week I'm joined by James and Jesse. Apologies listeners, we did miss an episode last week. We'll get into why very shortly, but first, gentlemen, how are we?
Exhausted. We'll get into that as well in a short beat. But yes, it's been a couple of absolutely flat out weeks, and I've been up till the wee hours in the workshop again, still trying to get the MG ready for this Saturday, because my sister's wedding has crept up on me, and obviously where I've not had a lot of free weekends, Project MG has rather stalled and slowed down. There was an engine in the car, and it's mechanically, physically attached to the car. It sort of needs the rest of the plumbing and wiring doing. So if it's ready for Saturday, it's still touch and go.
This is one of the situations where I say I told you so.
I'm hoping not, because I hate when people tell me that, and I also hate giving up on a project.
Remind us what the original deadline was?
Original deadline was Driver Day, which was what?
Which was when?
Which year, though? Which year, Driver Day?
It's been broken for two consecutive Driver Days, which is really annoying.
So end of April, we are now middle of July, so if you do this, you're going to be 3 months over.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We have contributors that are just as bad when it comes to deadlines. Let's just put it that way. I'm fine.
Are you ever going near a Ford again?
I did ironically drive through the same Ford that I broke it in the Jimny on the way back from Goodwood. But obviously we're going through a huge amount of dry spells at the moment. There's hose pipe bans through most of Berkshire, and that's reflected in quite how dry that Ford was when I went through it. So quite why I decided to go through it in the springtime two years ago.
When you finally do get it back on the road and it features in Classic Car Weekly's Hour Classics, what we should do is a little panel that says, when this car was last on the road, Donald Trump wasn't president, and all the other things, the big life-changing things that have happened since the midget last saw tarmac.
Which would have been the Thursday before Goodwood Revival last year.
I'm sure everything
that's happened in the world since.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we might have been a different prime minister. I'm not sure.
No, same prime minister. We've got a different American president. I think there's going to be some other significant things that have changed in the sort of intervening, nearly a year, basically. I think we're about 10 months at this point. So, yeah, I will try and sort of incorporate into the art class, say, what's happened since, and figure it out from there.
Okay. So, what's the backup?
Backup plan is I walk. Conveniently, it's being held at a church on the opposite side of town, so I just simply walk from... Actually, no, I was staying at my parents' house. I'm staying at the manor next to the church, so I've only got to really pop next door. There isn't a backup. We at the moment, obviously, the forecast isn't great either, and most of the cars that have been sort of organised into the wedding cortege are open-top cars. 19-something Morris Cowley Tourer. Well, the front part of it is covered, which is great for the driver. Sort of sucks for my mum and the bridesmaid, who'll be in the back of the car. The Riley that's supposed to be taking my sister and dad to the wedding. The two-seater has no roof at all. So, again, plans are being changed. A lot of friends and favors are being called in.
I see what's happening. So you're hoping in with all of that that's going on, just the fact that your midget's not going to be there is just going to be quietly sort of shuffled off to the side.
It might. I don't think it'll be forgotten. My friends and family are quite sort of not pernickety or vengeful, but they will make comment on the fact that, oh, was the MG not here? And I was like, that's got a roof, isn't it? I go, yeah, it does have a roof. It doesn't have an engine that works in it at the moment, or a working engine connected to the car. We don't even know if this engine works after the hours I've built in it.
So you're gonna cut a hole in the floor pan and just sort of Fred Flintstone it, yeah?
That could be the only solution. Although it sat sort of stationary in the garage long enough, I'm surprised the floor pan hasn't simply sort of disappeared from underneath it. But anyway, that's the... It's causing a great amount of stress in my life at the moment, and I think it's the anticipation of trying to find out if the engine even works. If, like, the hours and hundreds of pounds that I've spent rebuilding this engine have all gone for naught because it just doesn't work.
It's going to be spectacular either way.
Yeah, the fire is going to be incredible.
Oh, is that it? If it doesn't work, it's going to get torched.
No. I just have that little faith in my engineering ability.
Yeah. And I'm just going
to... He says, clearing that up for any insurance purposes that might be listening. It was not me that set fire to it. But yeah, I don't know. The anticipation is killing me. The stress level is killing me. And yeah, I was in the workshop till I think it was 11:30 last night when I left, after nearly throwing something through a window out of sort of pain and frustration. My eyes were going blurry trying to put the choke cable onto the number one carburetor, sort of going, I, nope, giving up.
James, it sounds like you did the right thing and just sold your Classic, eh?
Yeah.
Well, that's two of my Classic fleets are now gone. So before they broke, before I drove mine into Fords or anything else like that, which I could have easily done. Is everything right?
Yeah, press your microphone cable back in, if not, I'll swap the microphone.
Sorry, listeners, my technical problem here. Can you hear me now?
That's better, yeah.
I'm having to this is like, I'm remembering when David and I did Drive It Day it was London to Brighton in a MGB.
GTV8 was
V8. And I had to hold the gear stick in fifth gear for David because it kept popping out. So all along the motorway, he's driving along and I'm holding the gear stick in fifth gear.
The gear stick was popping out.
Yeah, it was just popping and the whole thing was popping out of fifth gear. And this is what I'm doing now with this microphone. Anyway, that's not interesting to listeners. But what hopefully is interesting is that I have sold my Peugeot 406, everyone knows, and obviously the Volkswagen Polo, the 1992 bread van, which I really do miss now. Mm-hmm.
It's been about a month now, hasn't it? It was beginning of June, which was the Anglia car auction sale. So
yeah, and you know, sold it for £1,100 at auction, and it's gone to a lovely chap and his, I think it's his son or his grandson. And who?
No, we've been getting some letters and correspondence through, haven't we? About been polishing it and getting it sorted. And
I was worried. I was going to T-cut it, but I thought that was down to its last layer. They've thrown caution to the wind and be like, right, let's just give it a bash. And turns out there were a few layers of paint there still that they could access. So it looks lovely now. So it's gone to. I couldn't be happier. It's literally this lad's got it now. He's just turned 18. It's his first car.
Yep.
It's a way of getting him into classics, and it couldn't have gone to a better buyer. I'm really, really chuffed. So yeah, it's good. Now I'm on the lookout for an Audi TT Mark One. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of my friends keep
one in the car park if you want it.
There is, but I don't think it's up for grabs. But
everything's up for grabs for the right price.
Depends on price and legality.
Hello, I have monies. Would you like it?
Oh dear. No, well, that's the thing. And I keep getting friends ring me up saying, I see an Audi TT for sale on my road or something. And it's normally a Mark II or Mark III. And I'm like, well, no, I need a Mark One. I need it to be, I feel like it's, I need a Mark One. Yeah.
Okay.
Do you want it with the baseball glove leather interior, the really nicely sort of stitched seat backs as well?
To be honest.
Look, don't make the mistake that I did, because when I sold the TR7, it was the better part of a year before I found myself a car. And it's because I started doing things like that. Oh, I want it with this. I want something with that. Just literally dive in and go for it sort of thing. And as long as it ticks enough boxes, then just crack on. The worst case scenario is that you don't love it and you can sell it.
Yeah,
so don't do what I didn't do without a car for a year.
And I'm a bit like that now, especially with kind of putting entries into our classics. I'm running out of things to say because
I'm
still looking, and I want to find the right one. And you know, so many of them have got lots. I mean, they do seem to go on for a few miles. So, and I did go to a garage the other day. They said parts are becoming harder to find, but they do share a lot of parts with Golfs. Mark IV, if I'm not mistaken. So it might not be too bad, but yeah, I've been so busy lately. I need to get on it, and yeah, I've been busy, and I've been, you know, at events with Mr. Billington here. Hence the reason we got, you know, listeners can't see, but we now have lovely tans because of it.
I certainly do. I got absolutely roasted at Goodwood Festival of Speed over the last weekend. It was baking hot and incredibly dusty, so I'm not entirely certain how much this is dry flaking skin, how much of it's actually just rally stage still falling off me.
We've got a load of events to talk about, and I've got not a lot to talk about my Mini, so I will move on. We should probably start with the main reason why there wasn't an episode of the podcast last week. And that was the Le Mans Classic. Jesse, James, where do I start?
it was epic. I will start by saying we allowed ourselves enough time to enjoy it and do the work this time. When we went in 2023, it was, right, get out there, get all the work done, and then race to get back home. And we didn't manage to...
A literal race to get home.
Yeah, we didn't. Whereas this time we had a bit of time. We got the work done, but we also were able to enjoy it as fans. And there's nothing quite like being trackside as they're about to start. And you see the run, the races run across the track to their cars and jump in, try and get started. It's, if anyone has a chance to go to Le Mans, any listeners, just do it. It's so much fun.
Yeah, it's an absolutely brilliant event. I think the best starting point for this is probably going to be St. Pancras International. We were supposed to be at starting it all off at Stansted Airport. We ended up starting from St. Pancras International because about 5 o'clock on the Wednesday night before we were supposed to go, we get a panicked email from sort of office manager Lisa, who had sort of booked all of our transport for us, going, they've cancelled your flights. And we're going, okay, that's a significant problem. How are we going to get to Le Mans to start with? So we end up booking trains to get to Le Mans, which is fair enough. France has a very good and fairly reliable train system, actually. So we're able to go Eurostar to Paris, tube across Paris, or metro across Paris, to use the local parlance, and then out of one of the train stations in Paris all the way over to Le Mans, which was quite nice, comfortable, relaxed, refined. We got a lot of work done. The latest Hour Classics I submitted to you was largely written on that second train.
Good work.
And then, that dropped us off in Le Mans, picked up the hire car and continued as normal. So the sort of functionality side of it there, great. We'll get to the return journey in a bit, but actually at Le Mans was sublime, and it is one of those events that properly sort of beguiles you with the atmosphere, excitement of it all. The scale of it as well is absolutely phenomenal, because the entire thing operates within the grounds of Circuit de la Sarthe, the 24-hour circuit. Mm-hmm. So it has a huge amount of space to play with, and it really does play with the entire thing. And the fact that you have this enormous infield that is just full of display cars, and sort of there's the campsites, there are sort of live music stages, live cinemas, and then there is just sort of this bustling town that just emerges for this four-day weekender. And yeah, I think this year we got lucky in the fact that we had a bit of time to actually explore and enjoy the atmosphere of the town, as opposed to just running around, photographing things, finding stories and writing it up. So it was,
what was your sense of the other Brits that were there sort of thing? Because obviously year before last, you drove there. Was it that the people you were speaking to, did they sort of do the same? Do you think, I mean, obviously there's a big sort of campsite, and there's a lot of people that sort of use that as a means of enjoying the event. They just see it as part and parcel of it sort of thing. But what were people affected by everything that was going on with, or wasn't going on with their travel?
I don't know. A lot of the people I spoke to, a lot of people that sort of saw me moaning about it online and were driving down. They sort of were aiming to camp there. They'd booked hotels there, and they sort of had elected to drive down, and they'd sort of immediately sort of jumped in offering lifts. So thank you to those that did. And also offered them sort of saying, oh, if you get stuck on the way back, I was like, you guys have had clearly a premonition of what is to come. Back at it now. That was... Yeah, I think a lot of Brits opt to drive because it's an enjoyable route down there. You take the auto route, you've got the lovely rolling French countryside, it's quiet, it's easy to get through on a car, and generally speaking, when it works, the ferries, the Eurotunnel system is quite useful, actually, and it works really quite neatly. I didn't get a chance to sort of bump into many sort of British tourists that were over there enjoying it. I was sort of racing around finding sort of the stories of the actual cars and bits of around the event. But there was a lot of British voices there. It's a great event for international sort of fans as well. There were people there from Australia, America. It was proper sort of four corners of the globe, people turning up to enjoy this. So it's more than just sort of Brits abroad and sort of a couple of French people rocking up to a circuit. This is enormous. We're talking, I think, 236,000 people in attendance.
Yeah,
we're talking, that's about a medium-sized Grand Prix on the Formula One calendar. It is huge, the draw this event has,
and it's not expensive in terms of entry. I mean, obviously you have to factor in travel and things like that, but in terms of just
price for 4 days is incredibly worthwhile, especially when you compare that to the recent prices that Goodwood have released for the Festival of Speed. We'll get to that as well. I think you're getting a hell of a lot more for your money at something like Le Mans Classic, because A, it's spread over 4 days, B, there is just so much to see, and C,
it's huge,
and also it is incredibly fairly priced as well. Like, they appreciate that a lot of people want to attend this. Yeah. They've made the price point a very accessible one.
I don't guess when it was that I was there last. It'll be a good few years, but I do remember there being a massive sort of collaboration between Porsche clubs, and there was like hundreds of 911s. And what really stood out for me was that they weren't packed in. It wasn't sort of, you know, a person width between each cars. It was, you know, decent spacing, and yet it still felt huge and massive sort of thing. So they have absolutely space for days sort of thing in terms of just the room to sort of expand out and just have that freedom. It's like, you know, several sort of football pitches worth of space just for individual exhibition sort of thing. So, and yet it doesn't feel spread out. It feels like it's lots to see.
Yeah. It's an endurance track, so you've just got so much space on the infield. Mm. I mean, like, well, some of the highlights there were like an amazing Dakar rally display of, like, you know, some of the all-conquering 4x4s that they had. And then they had 70 years of Renault Alpine, the Alpine brand. 70 years. How's that been 70 years? Crazy. So, well, the displays are, and there were some weird and wonderful kind of cars that had supported the Tour de France over the years. You know, like a Renault 5 with another Renault 5 on top of it. So it was almost mirrored the Renault 5 below it, and they turned it into a camper. And this was just on the infield. I mean, before we'd even got to the racing.
Like, honestly, I have no idea how you managed to unearth all of those gems without the use of like a buggy. Like, for getting around.
We got our steps in.
Racked up. Oh, like, yeah. So much steps.
I was talking about the pricing, though. I mean, once you're in and you've paid to get in, it's great. But obviously, as with most of these things, if you want a pizza or something like that, then the food, it's a good way of them, how they make the money. Once you're in, you've got to pay for their food. And, you know, to jump back in on the atmosphere of it, I remember because it's obviously middle of summer, it doesn't feel as late as it does when it's like 8, 9 o'clock. The sun's still up and you're watching racing. And then you think to yourself, oh, I'm a bit hungry. And then before you know it, you find yourself eating steak frites at midnight. And it's as busy as it is at midday. It's crazy. But that's the atmosphere goes on all through the night, which is quite something very unique to this event. I'd say you probably maybe don't get with other kind of live track events. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And No rest for the wicked.
It was
you did the Le Mans Classic at the beginning of the month, the first weekend of July. Last weekend, you were at the Festival of Speed.
Yeah, I mean, we're just wrapping up on Le Mans Classic. I've just found ticket prices. So if you wanted just sort of a roving ticket for 4 days with paddock access, which is what you want, so you can go and see the cars up close and personal, for 4 days, that's £180. And a friend of mine did send me, actually, the ticket prices for Goodwood Festival of Speed, because obviously they've just unveiled their tickets and prices for next year. And a 4 day admission, admittedly with grandstand, for Goodwood Festival of Speed, would you like to take a guess? Bearing in mind that 4 days at Le Mans Classic with paddock access is £180.
It's going to be at least double.
James, can I get an offer from you?
What's that? Sorry, say again.
4 days at Goodwood Festival of Speed, including grandstand seats.
I'm going to go £395.
£470 4 days.
Look, it's they're very different events, and whilst it, you know, those figures are quite disparate, I think they are sort of quite different events as well, sort of thing. So they do very different things, as you're about to get into. There's much more sort of new manufacturer presence. The Festival of Speed, to all intents and purposes, is sort of a series of hill climbs within an international motor show now, isn't it?
Yeah, Festival of Speed used to very much be sort of a hill climb version of, say, the Revival. It was sort of a case of, look at all these old cars in action, and that way they could get loads of people along one long line and show off all these interesting cars, which is great, but that was in sort of the 90s, when also the barriers used to be a single hay bale at the side of the track. It's grown a bit more since then. And now it's more the equivalent of like the British Motor Show, the sort of the Geneva Motor Show. It is that, but everything just happens to be in motion, and every now and then an old car goes on the track.
There is absolutely a classic element, which is why we went.
Yeah.
But realistically, you're going to potentially see cars that are going to be released for the first time at this event, aren't you? So saw it with the MG Cyberster last year and things like that. Yeah. For many people, that would have been their first eyes on that car. So
yeah, one of the grids is called the first glance sort of grid of cars that goes up, and it is a lot of new cars. It is a lot of manufacturers that I've never heard of that are sort of, this is their first time they're ever launching a car. And to appeal to a British audience, Festival of Speed is a great opportunity to do that, because it is live broadcast across the weekend. There is a highlights package that goes out on terrestrial television, I think. There is all the highlight reels that go out onto YouTube as well. So it is a great platform to launch new cars on. But Goodwood hasn't entirely lost its way and does weave into it these brilliant historical elements, these brilliant bits where you get these classic sort of threads run through it. And this year, the biggest one was, it's easily summed up as going celebrating Formula One, but it celebrates the winning formula, which is the idea that there is a great way to design a racing car, and that this sort of spread of racing cars across the eras and performance cars across the eras as well. So you obviously, Formula One is a great one to tie into that because the name matches. But on top of that, we had touring cars from across the eras, we had endurance racing cars, and then we had sort of slightly more obscure options. Obviously, we had a couple of rally cars woven into that as well. And then we had things like the Supervan, which is sort of based off of motorsports parts and sort of this idea of... Also, the Transit celebrates 60 years this year. In and of itself, the Transit formula is clearly a winner. Otherwise, Ford wouldn't still be making
Transit at Festival of Speed. I'm going to ask one thing. I did see on social media, I'm sure many of our listeners did, Nigel Mansell getting into his championship winning 1992 Williams with Riccardo Patrese. Did you see that there?
Yes, I did see the 14B. I think they had a variety of different Williams drivers, past and present, driving it. So I think they had Jamie Chadwick, who's one of their sort of academy drivers, on the Thursday, Leah Block on the Friday, James Vowles on the Saturday, the Williams team's principal. And then Sunday they had Mansell reunited with the car and also Riccardo Patrese driving it as well. I did interview Riccardo about it, and he sort of asked him, what's it like getting back into the car? And he was like, it's fantastic because it just sort of all comes rushing back to you. And the amount of the sort of older F1 drivers I spoke to about it, even the younger ones who are getting back into their cars for the first time, are like, it sort of all comes back to you at such a speed. So for getting to sort of meet and interact and sort of get these pieces of living history, whereas these sort of drivers are reunited with sort of cars from their past, was sublime. And as a Formula One fan, it is incredibly special in my mind to sort of go around and interview Damon Hill, Riccardo Patrese, Nigel Mansell, Felipe Massa, sort of speaking to all these people and sort of accumulating these sort of great moments of sort of personal magnitude, but also sort of from a journalist point of view, getting the chance to ask them questions and sort of go, what does it mean to be taking part in a celebration of a sport that has lasted 3/4 of a century? You sort of go, that's phenomenal that a sport has had such a long-lived and long-lasting sort of technological sort of importance. So you look at some of the things that have been developed through Formula One and motorsports that made their way to road cars, disc brakes, independent suspension, so on and so forth, safer fuel cells, safer fuels, seat belts. Everything in that line of sort of developments can be, if you want to, trace it back to Formula One. So it's great to see that sort of bit of history celebrated, but it wasn't just Formula One. We had 30 years of Colin McRae was celebrated. We had his daughter was being driven up the hill in one of his old cars. I think the chap she's dating is a current rally car driver in the championships. So it was great to sort of see this family lineage being sort of carried on and speak to the people preparing the cars and seeing the McRae family still so passionate about sort of supporting and honouring their dad's heritage.
I think for me, really nice. That's it. It can be quite, you can be very easy to be flippant about the pricing, but they are ultimately very different events. Those people, those sort of, you know, legends of motorsport, it's not by accident they appear at these events, particularly the Goodwood Festival of Speed. I think it has a cachet. It has an exclusivity. It has an aura around it that few other events can rival. And I think it is worth bearing that in mind when we look at those prices. Short of
like a top tier British Grand Prix, you're never going to have a celebratory moment with Nigel Mansell, Jackie Stewart. Who else do we have on the list? We had Mario Andretti. We had Emerson Fittipaldi. We had Jacques Villeneuve. We had Mika Hakkinen, and I think we had another one as well. Off the top of my head, I'm struggling to remember. Like, you had this sort of huge array of, I think there was one, possibly one more in there.
Not to mention all the support teams that are there. They're required just to get a car to start from the bottom of the hill and get it up to the top.
Yeah, like
sort of
the history.
That doesn't happen by accident.
Yeah.
The amount of wins you just mentioned in one sentence there, you mentioned all those names. You got to ask a lot of Formula One wins. Like how many podiums and championships, unbelievable. Going back to that Nigel Mansell car, they have to take along the same 1992 IBM PC computer that they had back then. There's a 386, I think, and they have to plug it in every single time because it's the only computer.
They have updated that a little bit. They found a way of transposing the software.
Is it an emulator?
Essentially, they're running an emulator on a Windows tablet sort of thing. But even getting it to start is still... Watching that car start is actually a really fascinating thing, because obviously this was a car that had the active suspension system. So the car would start up and then it goes through a little self-check process. and you watch the car start up. Yeah, and it literally sort of raises itself up on its suspension and then completely lowers itself down as it sort of settles itself down. You're like, oh,
that's... Does it confuse itself for a Citroen?
It's sort of, yeah, it's, like it's a malfunctioning BX at that point. You're sort of looking at it, that's kind of funny, but it's sort of getting to see this sort of history and technology alive and seeing Damon Hill in the P578 that his dad won championships with. But also, we had cars dating back to the early years of Grand Prix racing. Before it became Formula One, it was just Grand Prix racing.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're sort of talking like 1907 Mercedes going up the hill. You're thinking, the technology of this, the fact that you have to have a passenger with you to pump the fuel out of the tank manually as you're going, and it's sort of a crank on the front to start it. You sort of get these brilliant pieces of history are being brought together from sort of the most modern Formula One cars that are doing the hill to cars that are very much the sort of pre-genesis of that sport. And then on top of that, you've got the Concours, you've got all the other cars that are in the paddocks, you've got manufacturers that do celebrate a bit of their heritage by having older models there as well as sort of their new stuff they're launching. So there was a BMW there that I had to go up and ask the guy at BMW, so what is this? And it's essentially what's going to be the 3 and 4 series in about a generation's time. But it's got something ridiculous, like 2,000 horsepower from electric motors. And you're sort of going,
oh gosh,
that is a lot. And without wanting to besmirch them, knowing how people that buy M3s and M4s drive, I don't think giving them 2,000 horsepower is very sensible, considering how often they're able to bin it with 600. But that's... That's besides the point. It's the evolution of the technology as well as a great thing from a technological point of view. You can go along to Festival of Speed and enjoy it from a mechanical point of view. And also the fact that the paddocks are so open. And that is included naturally in the price of your ticket, is you can go around and you can see how they're maintaining all these cars. You can see how they're sort of put together to do a run. And certainly when it comes to the motorsport cars, the fact that you have to like preheat your engines, you're warming your tyres, everything from those points of view is astonishing. And then you get to the older cars where there is still the same level of care that's being applied to them, but in a very different way. You look at things like the Beast of Turin, it is very carefully maintained, and it does its showpiece of sort of running up the hill, spitting and popping flames. But when it goes wrong, it takes just as much sort of care and precision and unique engineering to make it go right again. So there are interesting parallels that you can draw. You can be very sort of artistic and poetic about it. But at the same time, it is just a bonkers and brilliant event to spend time at. And especially as a photographer, getting to get so much closer to the action, especially on the rally stage, where the rules of health and safety get a very sort of period sort of lashing of group B-ness to it. Whereas a case of the rules as a photographer are, do not stand in front of the car when it's coming towards you. Everything else is fair game. Whereas usually at racetrack, it's like you've got red zones you can't stand in, you've got to be behind barriers, you've got to stand behind catch fencing, use photographers' windows. On the rally stage, it's a case of don't get hit. So I sort of finished up shooting the rally stage on Sunday morning and sort of walking down the hill looking like I'd simply been rolling around in the dirt for the morning. I was just covered in it because sort of kneeling down right by the side of the track, getting these brilliant shots as 1980s and 1990s rally cars fly past you, kicking up dust and dirt, and sort of wearing sunglasses in the shade just to keep it out of my eyes, and then sort of sneezing and it coming out a sort of disgusting sort of fleckled brown colour, sort of going, oh, that's all inside me now. Festival Speed, incredible, but another 2 weekends back to back working, essentially 4 days in a row, shattered.
We need to move on from events because this is already running quite long, but I did just want to mention something we've not mentioned already. Le Mans Classic, now it's annual.
It is, yes.
Which is a massive deal, isn't it?
Yeah, previously this has been running sort of every 2 years, with biannually. So now we're going annually, 2026, it will be back at Le Mans. And again, the same sort of incredible arrays of classic racing cars all the way through from literally, this goes back to when Le Mans, the 24 Hours started, so 1923. So we have everything from there right up to, I think, the final grid ends in about 1986, 1989, somewhere around there. But then also you have the support races that include sort of modern endurance cars, modern GT cars. So there is a good span of cars that take part in this, and it is an event that is for everybody. Obviously, I don't recommend trying to get a child up until 3 a.m. to watch the racing, but it's approachable, it's enjoyable, and if you're looking for something big to plan to do next summer in a classic car sense, get along to the Le Mans Classic. I 100% recommend it.
Right. So, other things that we've got in the issue on sale today, 16th of July, our lead news story, we're looking at Iconic Auctioneers, which has something really special for its sale at next month's Silverstone Festival, not Classic, a collection of low-mileage Jaguars that are sure to sort of fire up buyers. It's headed up by a Jaguar XJS, a manual, 4-litre, six-cylinder convertible that has just 306 miles. It's a delivery mileage car. It's estimated at £80,000 to £100,000. The current record for an XJS, believe it or not, is a similar delivery mileage convertible at £131,000. So there is absolutely scope for this particular XJS to blow that estimate. There's various other cars. They've all come from a single collection. There's also a XK RS, so one of the newer sports cars. That's got even less miles on it. That's got 237, got an estimate of 30 to 35,000. And there is another XJS as well, this time a XJ RS Le Mans car. That's Le Mans car is in Le Mans edition, not a Le Mans motorsport car. That has 2,547 miles, and that's up for £55,000 to £65,000. There's going to be some big price achieved. What I wanted to ask you guys is, do you think that the results from this sale will result in an uplift in XJS prices?
I don't know if it will result in an uplift in XJS prices. XJS is going through a really interesting boom at the moment. Obviously, it's anniversary year for it, but it's a car that's become incredibly sort of well understood, sort of following in the wake of the E-Type. I think a lot of younger enthusiasts are also approaching XJS because it is quite approachable if you're mechanically minded enough and have the time to pour into it. They are a bit DIYable as well. You can fix the AJ Sixes in them as well. You can maintain them yourself, which is quite good. And also, it's comfortable and pliant enough to be a reliable daily car if you sort of properly service them. The question I have with this is, what's the point in buying a car that's that low mileage? Because you either drive it and you remove everything that makes it special, it just becomes an XJS with mileage on it. And also, if you want to drive it, you've got a car that's sat for so long doing so little mileage. What's the service record on it like? A car needs to be used to maintain it. Otherwise, you've got bearings that are going stiff. You've got bushings that are going to be perished. It's going to effectively be no different than a car that's covered mileage before you want to try and drive it. So I'm always baffled by these sort of low price ones. There was a Mini that was going through a sale in like a showroom recently. I think we even covered it in CCW.
Yeah, it was Kitchen Classics. Yeah. It was
was it a late Cooper? Yeah. Yeah. And I sort of go, okay, that's interesting, but why? Because you can't drive it because you lose the speciality of it. So you've just got essentially a paperweight. And if you do want to drive it, it's going to take a huge amount of recommissioning to make it any good to drive. Otherwise, it's just a barn find that's not got dust on it at this point. And I say that in the nicest possible sense.
I know. I think ultimately it's the uniqueness that you're paying for.
Yeah.
Quite apart from what it gets used for. I mean, at the end of the day, we're always advocating that you buy a car, you can do what you like with it. So if that means you want to modify it, if that means you want to prepare it for track racing, that's entirely up to you. You've paid the money, and that's in your gift sort of thing. So I don't think that it's a massive deal that these cars aren't driven sort of thing. And I think to a point that you're buying a museum, a personal museum piece. And if that's your bag, then entirely that's your bag sort of thing. In terms of how it's valued, again, I think it's just purely down to the fact that it's not repeatable. It can't be. Its value is in the fact that it is literally unique, that you will not find another one sort of thing. So what's interesting is obviously that, you've got this particular convertible that's £80,000 to £100,000, and yet you've got a newer sort of the XKRS that I'm looking at has less miles on it, and it is about less than half the price sort of thing. So I think it's interesting to me how it is that you've got particular cars that do exceed sort of thing, and I think that you are right. There is definitely a renaissance going on with XJS prices. We've seen that it's the anniversary year for them. They're 50 years old this year. I think they are finding their way into the limelight sort of thing. So I do think this sale could result in a bit of an upturn sort of thing. No one's going to go and sort of suggest that their car that is worth £15,000 is now suddenly worth 50. But I do think that they are becoming more appealing, and that will result in what they're valued at increasing. Same, James. What do you think?
It's a really lovely looking XJS. It's nearer the end of the line of the XJS. It's a 1994 and only ran on for two more years. So, it'll have be one of the most modern ones you can buy. I think for me, it's who buys it. Does a museum buy it and have it as a piece of history for all to come and see? Personally, for me, I can see someone buying it and adding 1,000 miles onto it a year, maybe, just so they can drive and enjoy it. Because it's going to get to a point where it will just sit and stand, and it'll become a piece of forgotten history. We'll get to a generation that no longer remembers it and no longer values it in the same way we maybe do.
Yeah.
Our generations do. So it's there to be driven and enjoyed, maybe not to go over 100,000 miles, but I could certainly see someone buying it who thinks, right, I've got a chance to return to 1994 as if I've just bought it from the showroom, because you only live once, and why not?
I think I'm so thankful of what the work the Jaguar Daimler Heritage Trust does. I mean, they have the last of the line Jaguar X convertible, and we drove it.
It was at festival speed as well.
Exactly. You know, these are pieces that are sort of worthy of sort of being put in front of you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, sort of thing. And I feel very privileged as a member of the Motoring Press that I have access to those cars, and I can be afforded access to them by this charity, sort of thing. So, delivery mileage cars aren't going to go away, and their appeal isn't going to go away. I do hope that I do want to see an uplift in prices for HJSs, because I think they have been historically undervalued. I just don't want them to get to the point where they're now suddenly out of reach and they become along the lines of like a Series 3 E-Type, which is just it's unfathomable. You can't sort of spend. There's very few people that can at the drop of a hat spend £50,000. Certainly, who are interested in Classic Car Weekly anyway. With the sort of we do try to sort of pride ourselves looking at those cars that are that bit more attainable, sort of thing. And I hate to see the XJS depart from that sort of bracket. But yeah.
I don't think understand is the correct phrase, but I get why there is an interest in sort of why delivery mileage cars make headline news. Certainly cars that have sat for as long as this has without accruing that mileage, because there's certainly an interesting story behind sort of how a collector comes to have these cars, why they choose to do what they do with them. That to me is interesting. I get that point of it. And the sale point when they come up, it's a common thing we always say when it comes to market pieces. What auctioneers and sort of auction experts will always say is it's only worth what the market will pay on the day.
Yeah.
And that's the interesting thing. But obviously some of that can be led by the provenance, and it can be led by the fact that this is a delivery mileage XJS. It is a one-off opportunity to own something like this. And yeah, there is this sort of current peak of interest for the XJS. So we're going to see an interesting price for it. And I think certainly what it will do is sort of revitalize the sort of XJS in sort of the sort of media circle, and sort of bring it again to the fore of sort of the idea, and will hopefully sort of continue to spur on interest in the model. I think is going to be a good thing. It's going to be a flagship that will sort of herald this sort of again renewed interest in the car. So I think it's worthwhile talking about, it's worthwhile covering. I'm interested to see what it does, but not what this specific car does, but what it does for the market.
Yes.
I think that's my interest certainly in this lies, knowing sort of people my age sort of in their 20s, early 30s are buying XJSs because it's sort of an interesting car that was just, it was sort of the cheap car challenge option on Top Gear so many times. When we were growing up, you sort of had it for the sports coupes that aren't like Porsches. You had it for the, can you turn a car into a train? It was that sort of thing, that it was always a car we were aware of, and it was always a cheap option for doing something. But now we're sort of getting to an age where we're nostalgic for that idea of it. We're sort of going, oh, well, these are affordable. There are specialists that can help us maintain them. For those who want to and can, it is a very good option to get into that classic car world. And I think that should be encouraged. And the fact that this is going to bring that to sort of the mindset once again is worth sort of celebrating.
Yeah, and I mean, this particular car is a six-cylinder, as we've sort of mentioned. When we drove that last of the line XJS, I think we both agreed that the 4-litre six-cylinder engine, the AJ16, that really was a sweet spot in terms of offering the best of sort of, you know, compromise between, you know, sporty handling and grand tourer ride sort of thing. So, but you know, you mustn't forget, like the V12, you're doing well to get a V12 engine or anything. I think that XJS is a really good entry point if you want that sort of to say that I own this sort of this pinnacle for some people in terms of like engine sort of thing. So
yeah, the V12 was a really nice piece of engineering, and again the work that went into it, and what Jaguar the Jaguar V12 was always a question of what could have been in so many cases. It could have been in the XJ220 and so on and so forth. And it's one of those things that it's sort of so intrinsically tied with so many brilliant pieces of British motoring history that I think if you get a chance to buy a V12 one, certainly have a look at it. Obviously, budget appropriately for sort of servicing and maintaining it.
Yep.
But the XJS is always one of those cars that has, as you covered in the feature you wrote earlier this year, such a brilliant history to it as well. And it's so sort of well endowed in the British psyche, sort of going,
it was a Jaguar. It was a unique selling point then. And I argue it remains a unique selling point now, sort of thing. So yeah.
Without wishing to retread sort of the already tired thing of Jaguar's rebrand, I think that's also sparked this sort of rekindling of love for older Jaguars in a huge broad demographic, because no one my age really resonates, certainly my age in the car buying world or car enthusiast world, hugely resonates with what Jaguar sort of have rebranded to, that advert that sparked so much sort of internet sort of discourse. None of us sort of came away from that and went, oh yeah, I'll have a new Jag. We all sort of went on Auto Trader, eBay, Classic Cars for Sale, and sort of pulled up what older Jaguars were and went, that, I will have a bit of that. And I think that's what the XJS represents, is this important thing of other generations coming to Jaguar and going, that is the brand that I like, and that is the brand that I want to sort of continue to support and continue to maintain the history of.
And that's the model I want, rather than the XK8, which arguably has sort of been occupying that what you just described. I think people, you know, that car has now gone from sort of being a secondhand car to being a classic in its own right as well. And I think there's a bit of clear water between the two of them now, sort of thing. So
the XK8 is still an interesting proposition. And certainly I think it's currently where the XJS was about 20 years ago.
Yeah.
It's sort of a bit of a forgotten option for sort of buying a grand touring sports car, sports coupe, convertible. Yeah. And I think it's probably one of the cheapest way you could buy your way into a V8 at the moment as well.
It used to be. Maybe a V8, but you used to be able to get an XK8 about 5-10 years ago. Certainly when I drove one for CCW for about a couple of grand, and now that's probably tripled, I'd say.
Yeah, but still sub 10K.
Absolutely.
So still sub-10K. In the context of classic cars as a whole, you know, you can have this V8 engine sort of sports car for the same price of a ragtop Morris Minor. They're different cars, but it's a comparison nonetheless.
It was about the same time you could get a Boxster for about 2.5K as well.
Yeah.
That's
if you shop around, you can still get a Boxster for 2.5K. It's a question of whether or not you should. It's the same. It's the thing. The same argument could be applied to the XK8s, the XKRs, and the S's that followed. Is you could buy them really cheap, and you still can if you shop around. If you find people that are sort of have had their fun with it and aren't looking to sort of flip it to make a profit, just looking to get a shot of it, you can find those cars out there. And I think it is great for the longevity of the brand, and certainly the longevity of the history that it went through at the time, the sort of Ian Callum designs, the Ford ownership, and the part sharing that it went through. Those are really interesting pieces that I think my generation are now being sort of led back to Jaguar and sort of supporting its history more than its modern countenance.
Yeah. Big feature in this issue, we look at the Porsche 964 Carrera RS. And we pit it against the TVR Griffith 500. Now, on the face of it, this seems quite daft. We're pitting £250,000 worth of Porsche versus 20K versus TVR sort of thing. But there's an awful lot of similarities between these cars. We've got ultimate expressions of drivers' cars for their respective marks. 0 to 60 times that are very similar, sort of 5 seconds. Very similar performance figures. They go about doing it sort of different ways. We've got sort of like this incredible sort of weight-saving purity for the Porsche, and then we've got just pure V8 grunt for the TVR. Gents, which would you have? Money, no object.
Ooh, money, no object. That's a tricky one. I'm going to say TVR.
Still.
I just love the sort of wildness and the, again, much like I said with Jaguar, it's the strange sort of British engineering heritage that's sort of endued in the sort of the TVR that's really quite fun. It's just this ridiculous idea of lightweight sports car, just shoving the biggest engine possible. I think it's a bit of sort of the muscle car sort of idea, but transposed into a British sports car, and I quite like that. I like the fact that it's an innately flawed car, and I do enjoy that. That's why I have a 1500 midget. They're an innately flawed idea. And I think, yeah, that it speaks to me in sort of a slightly silly level, plus also I just like a car that sort of constantly feels like it's trying to throw you into a hedgerow. I think that's why I really enjoyed the Cobra I drove a couple of years back as well.
Yeah.
Which very nearly did throw me into a hedgerow. But
Well, no, you nearly threw yourself into a hedgerow behind the wheel of a Cobra.
Yeah, don't blame the car, mate. Come on. It's also not the midget's fault. It went swimming.
Maybe there's a pattern of logic here, but anyway.
James, you designed this particular feature. What side of the fence do you sit on?
It's a tough one because I'm not going to base this on the colour of the car. I'm not really a pink car kind of guy.
It's a fuchsia sort of example that we've got, isn't it?
And when you flick through it, you'll notice it straight away because it's with that lovely green TVR. So here's the thing. Money, no object. My first toy car was a Porsche 964 Carrera. So my nostalgia is always going to bear on that. If I wasn't, if I take myself away from that, I probably would go TVR. I love the fact it's so unique. It's so different. There's nothing out there like it. You know, you could argue that a Porsche like that, you do see them almost one a week, probably, I would say, on the road somewhere. Whereas how many TVR Griffiths do you see? And the fact that it's got upside down Vauxhall Cavalier rear lights, it's just cool.
They've
turned those into what's a standard looking car's rear light cluster into something that looks really groovy, and I love it for that. So I'm torn on this one, but if I had to make a choice, I'd go back to my youth and be like, drive the car I had as a toy.
Well, we'll
Chris, then deciding vote from you.
I think probably the TVR. I think but it's very close. I mean, ultimately, you can form your own decision. This particular feature was written by our colleague, Sam Dawson. He clearly spent a lot of time doing his research and is properly in love with both these cars. It's a really, really good read that I can thoroughly recommend. So definitely, if you do get to shops, pick it up, give it a look, sort of thing. So some of the bits and pieces we've got in this issue to keep an eye out for. We got news that there's going to be a auction exclusively for German cars that's going to be hosted by auction company Dorries. We've also got a really nice story about a 17-year-old chap who has completely mechanically overhauled his MGB GT. You might want to have a word with him, maybe get some tips, Jesse.
If he's available for work from tonight and through most of tomorrow, he's welcome to join me in the workshop. Just give me a hand on the few fiddly bits.
And as always, we've got a really, really good The Way We Were. So this one is set in Oxford in 1962. And I won't spoil it, but give it a read because there's some really big changes coming. It's really interesting to see what's going on before it all occurs. I think we really should wrap things up there because I would not be surprised if there's quite a tall runtime on this one. Gentlemen, thank you very, very much for your time as always. And we look forward to bringing you another episode next week. No more cancelled episodes. We promise.
Cancelled episodes. We will be back to our regular weekly schedule. The paper's been weekly. The print comes first, and then we try and slot this in as best as possible. We've had some absolutely manic weeks, as you will have heard. So, yeah, we'll be back.
We're not going to be affected by air traffic controllers going on strike. So.
No, I'm planning. They're sort of shutting more and more of the A1 to do road work, so I might be flying in and out of Peterborough to get to it from the office. So we'll see what air traffic control makes of that.
Thank you very much, everybody. Goodbye.